Sophie LeRae is an entrepreneur, an author, and an experienced business facilitator. In 2003, she co-founded Nasiba, a business facilitation company specializing in emerging markets. She's the founder and spokesperson of the Global Women in Leadership Economic Forum. She's also the co-author of Game Changers, How Women in the Arab World Are Changing the Rules and Shaping the Future. Sophie was born in France and holds a master's degree in ancient history. She's a proud mother of two beautiful girls. Her passions include ancient cultures, mountain trekking, and vegan cuisine. We are here with Sophie. Sophie LeRae, what an amazing woman. A game changer, an entrepreneur, a wonderful mother. We call her Superwoman. Sophie, welcome.
Thank you for the amazing.
Sophie, let's go back to your childhood. Is there a moment of inspiration? Is there a moment of reflection? Somebody who helped to change your life?
Well, there's many. Starting, I guess, with my dad, he was a great inspiration in a way. An extremely positive person who had a very, 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 very eventful life, and saw it always from an extremely positive perspective. He almost died when he was 1 year old. He had tuberculosis all his life, and he lived his life to the fullest. So he was an inspiration.
Any wild experiences in your youth that you'd like to share, which managed to shape
no,
your life?
No, because my children probably will watch this interview, and I'm supposed to be this great role model. I was a bit of a naughty girl. Mm-hmm. I was quite rebellious. So my school days were tainted with a lot of detention, and I was brought up in a Jesuit school, which didn't help the rebellious aspect of my personality. It actually tuned it and, you know, made it even stronger.
So did that give you the starting point of your sort of inner strength, your inner core of being independent-minded?
Probably, but I think my sense of independence comes from my upbringing. I was my parents were both entrepreneurs in different ways. My father was an editor in chief in a newspaper. My mom was an entrepreneur. They brought me up as a independent person. One thing that shaped my not my childhood but my teenagehood was a friend of my mom. Who got divorced when she was in her 50s, and she was a very well-off lady because her husband was a well-off surgeon, and she had made the choice of being a housewife, and she brought up two wonderful kids, and she got to 50, and she had nothing left, mm-hmm. And it was extremely hard for her to go back to the corporate world, yeah, to work. She did eventually, mm-hmm. And she succeeded in what she did, and I remember her telling me, never, ever, ever lose your financial independence, because you lose, it's not just financial, you lose your self-esteem, you lose a lot of things in the process, and you get to a point in your 50s where it's much, or 40s, where if something happens, it's a big fight you will have to put up with. And that's something that shaped me, because I always thought, of being independent in all sorts of ways, in thoughts and in financially as well, and being then it led me to be curious about the world and so on, and to travel and so on.
Give us a flavor of your business journey. You graduated in life sciences.
Yeah. Well, my business journey is a bit of it's a strange thing. I wanted to be a teacher.
Right.
I wanted to be a university teacher. I did my degree in ancient history. Mm-hmm. I'm passionate about ancient cultures. I did a double degree because I did this in art history. I worked in a gallery. I worked in different things. I started my journey towards my becoming a teacher. And as I started teaching, I realized that the system, the kids I loved, mm-hmm. I loved it. But the system was just not working with me, or I wasn't working with the system. But I like to think that the system was not working with me. So I said, how am I going to be able to mix my desire of keeping to learn, mm-hmm. and researching, and at the same time give something to others, the product of my research, and do it in an environment where I build the system, basically, so it fits me. It took a while. It's not a thought process that led me from A to Z right away. So I worked for a very free spirit man at the time, who was a tour, I don't know how you call this in English, but it's like a tour operator for major concerts. Mm-hmm. And they do all the marketing and the PR and the communication of that, not the organization. Mm-hmm. And I started in PR. So for rock stars, for a lot of, at the time, a lot of hip hop stars. So you see, it's strange, right? It's... And that led me to conferencing, and then I left. I had gone to the United States to study for a while, and I always wanted to move out at some point. So it led me to England, and then it's another story. Then there was a point where I finally saw how I could, I guess, build the bridge between, you know, my aspiration and the business. And I created Nasaba with my husband, who was working in the same company, in the same conference company than me. And we started it in a basement in the south of France. Really a basement. Above us there was the parking, yeah, the parking garage. So we didn't have any lights. There was one window. It was my office right by the window.
Yeah.
And we had one table. We were the fifth of us at the time. And I remember, it's as funny as it is, it was the office I was the most proud of. Mm-hmm. I was so proud of that office, mm-hmm, because it was mine. So it was a really, really exciting moment.
Your company is called Nasaba, mm-hmm, which is derived from Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean?
Well, it means it's a idiomatic expression, Naseba Naru, and it literally means when there's a will, there's a way. It's to become. It fits different things. It's our DNA. When we created this company, we created with almost no cash. It was our 50 grand or 60 grand at the time, that's it. No outside investors, no business plan. No, but wow, an incredible, I mean, we did not think for a second about failing, not even for a second. And we wanted a name that would translate that, mm-hmm, would translate strength we had inside, that strength that was coming from the certainty of succeeding, mm-hmm, and we wanted to be Japanese because Scott had lived in Japan for 7 years, and there was a very strong, still a very strong attachment to Japanese culture, and it's still the case because we like to see ourselves a bit as samurai sometimes, the last ones.
When you plan for absolute success always, mm-hmm, with no thought of failure, mm-hmm, how does failure affect you? Because I'm sure you must have had ups and downs as you went through life.
Oh my God.
Precisely, so tell us about that.
Hmm. Chronologically,
perhaps.
By alphabetical order.
Yeah, chronologically would be good.
I guess the first ones, you take it very, very personally.
Yeah.
Mm, for sure.
Can you share one or two of those with us?
Yeah. One that I took really personally, and it's probably the one episode that was very, defining of who I have become in my journey as a business person, is a situation we got into. So we started in a basement. We started with little money, with our cash. We grew up to three offices. We opened an office in Dubai. We opened an office in Bangalore. So we were on a roll, right? 3 years into the business, and we signed some great partnership. And this is on pure stamina, you know, excitement. I was, we started the company, I got pregnant, I had the baby, I left the office, I had the baby. 2 days later, I was back in the office with the crowd. So it was all energy, 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 energy. And we get the opportunity to get some outside investors. We had no clue of, you know, the financial world, so we accepted the big boys. We accepted to go public. We really thought it was the right thing to do. Well, that's another discussion for another day, but it, and we ended up with suddenly a lot of cash, and we were told, go out and spend it.
Yeah.
And, oh, wonderful, let's go and spend it. So we opened many offices, two or three. Mm-hmm. We grew by, in 1 year, by, I think it was 300%, something. So crazy.
How much money did you raise?
We raised, the first time we raised 7 million, which was a lot for our little company. So we had three offices. We ended up the year after with six offices, mm-hmm. and we did a joint venture in China. So that joint venture in China looked wonderful. We spent a lot of money into it. We gave some cash to the joint venture partner. We invested cash into it. We were 50-50. It was all beautiful, right?
Yeah.
We were all friends. We loved each other.
Everybody's perfect.
Yeah, it was perfect. We had this beautiful office in Shanghai, and all our, you know, your ego as an entrepreneur is so flattered by all this, because you have all those offices and stuff. And then we, 2008, arrived. In the summer of 2008, we were extremely, it started actually beginning of 2008, we were extremely concerned about, we could sense things were happening on the market. The American market was a bit too bullish on certain things. The real estate was going down. So we were a bit worried, and we were very much interested in the Middle East. So we said, let's reduce our French office, because we were still in Monaco at the time, and let's move the headquarters in Dubai, which was reflecting back the right thing to do. We went to Dubai in September 2008. We moved all the management into Dubai, and then the crisis hit. And then I get a, so this is in the space of, I would say, 2 weeks after the Lehman Brothers. So clients stopped to pay. Bill starts to really, you know, inflate. You have crisis in all the offices, and then I get a phone call from the Chinese office after I ask a few questions about the audit we had made, and I heard the partner saying, I think you need to buy me back. So we went there with lawyers, we started negotiating, we said, no, that's not what we're supposed to do, we're 1 year in the partnership, you can't do this, we need to build it together, we've invested, blah, 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 blah. We get to an agreement, I leave Shanghai, and when I arrive here, I get a phone call from somebody in the office saying, they've left, there's nothing left. So I went back and with the lawyer, and we got to the office, this beautiful office in Shanghai, and there was nothing left, nothing, no furniture, no staff, no servers, everything had been gone. So that defining moment, because I can see it, and I couldn't enter in the office because the lease agreement was done in a way where he was the one,
yes.
the joint venture partner was the one. Anyway, this moment of total, really absolute failure in a sense, because everything crumbles down at the same time, and I had to go back to Dubai to do a lot of firing, because we had to fire almost half of the organization. Well, I took it very personally. Because it's your company, it's your baby, it's all you.
Yeah.
So that was the moment where, and that's, I think we all entrepreneurs have that moment in their, and thank God this moment happened very early in our organization, because I cannot imagine what it feels to have this situation, the carpet basically pulled under your feet when you're already at another stage in your organization. It must be very difficult to handle. But we handled it. We started it almost from scratch again.
Right.
The one thing we did is cut it off, not doing lawsuits, not doing anything, because otherwise you just you just carry on with that pain and you can't focus on the business.
Do you think it is better to have a job versus having a business, having your own business? And how do you compare the two in your life?
Well, it's two completely different things. It depends on who you are, your aspiration. But to answer your initial question, as long as I am a believer of doing what you're doing to the best of your abilities and to really, it's like life, to the fullest of your abilities and to accomplish and to fulfill yourself in what you do. Whether it is in an NGO, in a job, like you say, in a corporate job, or sweeping the floor, or being a business person, or being an entrepreneur, it doesn't matter. As long as you do it really with all your heart, then it's extremely rewarding, right? And you can see anywhere when you see somebody with a big smile on his face when he's doing his job.
Yeah.
Because he's doing it to its fullest. That's what's, to me, the most important. Now, and I'm saying this extremely sincerely, I really don't see any difference between jobs. I look at people before the job. Of course, you cure cancer. It has an added value in life, more than being, you know, doing conferences, for example. But it's really what's behind, what's your purpose, and what's firing you inside that matters. Then entrepreneurship is a journey for some kind of people. Not better or worse, it's just some kind of people. You need a level of resilience that not everyone has or that everyone wants to apply to their career. Sometimes you can apply resilience to other things. So I don't think being an entrepreneur is being a hero. That's my point. It's just, it fits certain characters.
Right.
But being an entrepreneur, the type of profile I'm looking for example, when I recruit my team, are people that have entrepreneurship, a very strong entrepreneurship sense, that can handle themselves, that see it as their own. That's extremely important. But you can do it in a job. You can have a sense of your own,
yes,
of ownership into a job.
Game changers. Tell us about your journey in becoming an author and what you felt while you were writing this.
I don't know if I'm an author. Let's not get...
okay. You got your name here.
Yes. No, but this is a topic that I'm particularly interested in, and it was my part of the book was more of gathering my experience and my humble thoughts about my experience, but mainly putting a light on women and men, because it's not just women, that I have met along the way of that experience and that have been a source of inspiration, and asking them basically the same questions and see, you know, if there was a lot of differences or not, and not so much. So you see a pattern in all those profiles. And then my co-authors, David and Radhika, have brought the academic aspect to it, because they are deep thinkers and very specialized in the HR aspect of gender diversity and in establishing programs and so on. So I had the fun part.
Okay, good.
I had the fun part because I was interviewing people, was getting, you know, things out of them, and it was great, because what you're doing is such a wonderful job, you know, getting to get people to speak about them, about their experience. I love it.
You focus on women in the Arab world and changing rules and shaping the future. What were your key findings?
Diversity, the need for diversity is everywhere the same. The issues that women face around the world are, I mean, pretty much the same as well. The way they handle it is different. And I found that in this region in particular, there's a very smart way of handling women challenges. I've been in this region now since 2002. I moved here in 2008, and I've been very, very too often asked, oh, you live in the Middle East, your own business, how do you deal with it? How difficult is it? You know, all those silly questions you asked. And I keep repeating the same thing. So I finally wrote it. So, so now I give my book and say, okay, read this. I found women that are extremely powerful, that are challenged, that need balance in their life like anywhere else, but that deal with it without losing their femininity. Mm-hmm. And that helped me a lot as well, because I always was torn when I was younger in England, for example, or in France, in between, do I need to look like a guy to, you know, to kind of be assertive in your face? Or can I be who I am? Mm-hmm. And when I'm who I am, sometimes I'm not being taken seriously enough by the boys.
Sure.
Especially in France. Because my country is not famous for its... it's a bit chauvinistic, let's face it.
What is your message to young women?
Keep fighting with grace. So... you know, just do what you want, the way you want. You want to be a basketball player, be a basketball player. You want to be a rocket scientist, be a rocket scientist. This is not a very deep message. It's just, I think the young girls don't need a message. They have the message very, very well in their head. I gave the book to my daughters and they said, you know that this is completely, it's over, Mom. What's the problem?
So what is the message to the boys, number one? And what is the message to employers, and especially male employers? Because you're talking about women game changers here.
Yeah.
And you've also spoken about a lot of men in there who have being empowered, I mean, supporting the empowerment process.
Yeah.
So what do you say to the employers and the boys?
I was reading an article on LinkedIn yesterday, wrote by the CEO of an ad agency here, and he was referring to, I don't know if you've seen the scandal or the mini scandal of what the CEO of Saatchi and Saatchi said about women, that they can't they sometimes cannot get to senior level because they don't want it enough. Well, he was fired. So I guess the employers understand that it's time to get rid of this incredible dinosaur mentality. So my message to boys is be prepared to have a generation of girls in front of you that are empowered, that are strong, that have that know what they want and how they want it, and that are extremely well equipped to get what they want, because they succeed better in studies. It's proven now, it's well documented, including in STEM fields in this region. The confidence level has raised up. Organizations are pushing female talent much more, and I mean through the pipeline. So there's going to be a lot of opportunities for women. And I'm actually a bit concerned that we're going to have a situation at some point where it will be the opposite. So especially in this region, because in this region, the female talent pool, the young female talent pool, especially at high school level, is high school and university level. And the level of desire, again, of will to succeed, of resilience, is very high. And it's an issue, it's a political issue, because what do you do with the generation of guys, boys, that are not as motivated, that are not as whatever, and that are going to be challenged even more in their position. It's a risk, huh? It's a political risk, because what do? They go for something else, they become whatever.
What advice would you give to young women who are coming up, who have all of these challenges and all of these different elements in their lives that they have to balance and pull together? What advice do you have for them?
Stop seeing them as challenges. So stop looking at all the challenges and just go for it. You're young, usually energetic.
Yeah.
Well, if you not change your diet, and take care of yourself.
Yeah,
that's for sure. Because if you're healthy in your body, you feel good about yourself. You're healthy in your mind, and you can address more challenges at a time. But really, change your perspective. Shift your mind towards opportunities. It's easier said than done, but be thankful and grateful for every single thing that happened to you. You're standing on your feet, you have a business, you have the opportunity to be here in Dubai in a country that is, you know, super cool. Be thankful. Yes, it's hard. Yes, you can't find the money. Oh, yes, but things will come. Have a purpose. Know why you are here. Don't try to get to the shortcut. To take every shortcut to get to the top first. Just enjoy the journey, enjoy the climb, enjoy the... And you climb and you fall and you climb again and you fall again. But when you get to your top, your mountaintop, it's wonderful. But it's the whole process that's exciting. Be thankful for that. I even the worst moments in my career, I have got to that point where I'm thankful for them because they've all taught me something, for sure. And I'm very sincere in saying that. Well, sometimes at the moment it happened, I would have preferred it not to happen, but...
Sure. What advice do you have? What nuggets do you have for people in terms of who are starting out to go through this whole curve, this growth curve and the scaling curve that you have gone through over the last, say, 10 years or so?
Well, I'll refer again to the top of the mountain. Mm-hmm. It's part of our, it's part of who we are at Nasaba. Yeah. We use a lot the mountain vocabulary because we all like to hike or climb or whatever, but because there's a sense to it, there's a lot in it that is like entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. You start, you hear, you want to get there. So some will take a helicopter and get there. Mm-hmm. It's an option. It's not very rewarding, at least in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And you don't learn much along the way. You have a nice view.
Yeah.
But every step of that journey teaches you something. So I'd say that my biggest advice would be see the top. Mm-hmm. You know where you want to go. You lay the foundations of where you want to go. You take your time in that. Mm-hmm. You enjoy that. You're grateful for that. Then you need to go to the next step. And this is from somebody who tried a few shortcuts and got slapped along the way.
Yep.
Shortcuts don't work, but that advice will not be followed by anybody. Everyone will listen very politely.
Yeah.
And if there's a shortcut, of course, we're all humans. We want to try to take it.
Yeah.
So that's my biggest advice. And the single biggest advice for an entrepreneur is to breathe. It is to breathe because there are so many moments in the life of an entrepreneur that if you allow yourself to stop breathing, and it happens to all of us at least 10 times during the day where you realize that you're so much into something, you're so intense and it's so stressful and your whole body just gets like this. Take moments to just breathe and have a more composed mind to face that challenge.
Celebrating your 90th birthday.
Me too.
What will we be celebrating? What will we be saying that you have achieved? You're only halfway there. You're very young.
Can I see the party first?
You can see the party. Yeah. You can see the party.
So I've established that for my 50th, and let's say for my 90th, because I think it would be good, I want to do a massive karaoke.
Okay.
Like giant one. So be ready. Choose your songs.
Okay.
And make sure that you can still song at 90 years old, right? Okay. Even if you song... if you don't sing very well. So that's the first thing. What would I have achieved? Well, I hope I would have achieved... the first thing is my family. Mm-hmm. So I will be with my daughters. They will have probably, most certainly, their children. They will be, I guess, well-balanced and accomplished women by that time. That would be a great, 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 great achievement. That would make me very happy. It's very, very, very important for me. Doing whatever they want to do, but enjoying it. I would hope I would have left something behind me, whether through my career or by helping or by training and supporting, you know, the people that have been throughout my life, my team members, my colleagues, my partners. That's mainly what I would like to see myself. I'm not going to cure cancer. I'm not going to build a rocket science. That's not going to be possible. But being a good person, being somebody that will be reminded as a kind person, someone that has been there for you, or that has been helpful for you, or that has helped you going through a period of your life, would make me very proud.
You see a lot of people coming to you with ideas. Do you give greater emphasis to ideas or execution, and why?
Well, one of our motto is make it happen. So you need to have an idea. So ideation is extremely, I mean, it's essential. You can't make happen something if you don't have the idea. But the execution is where the concrete stuff is happening, right?
What have been your top three challenges in your life?
Myself. My biggest challenge is myself. I am very critical about myself. I'm very cynical about myself. So I have to fight myself a lot. I'm a Scorpio, so I like to do this to myself. I don't like to be mean to other people, but to myself very much. My second biggest challenge is the same, actually. No, that's my biggest challenge. Second challenge would be, I guess, that sometimes that light of cynicism towards things. So for that matter, I'm very, very lucky. I have a partner who is on the complete opposite of the spectrum, who is extremely open and optimistic. So it helps us balancing it out. The third challenge, I don't see, it's funny, I have a hard time telling you about challenges because I have many little challenges, but I can't really see my life being blocked by anything. I don't know if I make sense in what you say.
You make total sense, absolutely.
So my sole challenge is the fight that I have with myself in order to get better, to improve myself on a daily basis. And I do a lot of work on that.
Many millions of people will be watching this interview. What is your key takeaway? What is that one final message that you'd like to deliver to the masses?
The future is bright. It's a bit messy right now, but the future is bright because this new generation coming is smart, smarter, and kinder, I think. So,
what a wonderful message to end this, Sophie. Real
Thank
pleasure.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.